Journalism in the United States is under severe strain. Yet despite shifts in the marketplace and sustained attack on specific news outlets by the current president, outstanding reporters like our guests this week continue to shape our understanding of the world around us. She's Mary Jordan and he is Kevin Sullivan this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that by visiting each week with the best contemporary storytellers, authors, scholars, filmmakers, and journalists, really anyone using narrative to explain the world we live in. This week, we're joined by two accomplished storytellers. Mary Jordan is national political correspondent for The Washington Post, and Kevin Sullivan is associate editor and senior correspondent covering national and international affairs, also for The Washington Post. Kevin and Mary, thank you so much for being with us.
Our pleasure.
So, not only do you work at The Washington Post together, but you're also a married couple.
That's right. So
I want to start with sort of the reality of collaborating with your life partner. Professionally, how does that work? How do you come up with a story? How does that evolve?
I write something and then Mary fixes it. And we have a very simple rule. That's how we do it. No, we've just been doing it for so long that it's really become second nature. We were overseas for 15 years. We were in Tokyo, Mexico City, and London as the bureau chiefs there, and we wrote, I think we've had 400 or 500 double bylines in the Washington Post over the years. And you know, alone out in the field, you get used to working together. And then when we came back to Washington and they broke up our little carnival act and we had to work separately, I felt like I was typing with one hand. I really felt like I was at a handicap. So, but I always still have my best editor and always make sure that everything I write, Mary reads and vice versa.
I mean, we quite often just pull up side by side. Our desks were always back to back, you know, so we were shouting back and forth, and you know,
in the bureaus
and all
now
around the world.
In the Post,
and we set that up in our house too, because we've written a couple books together. But I would say at least once a week somebody comes up to me and says, if I were writing with my husband, I would kill him. How do you do this?
Only once a week.
You know, at least, including my sisters saying that, how do you do this? I do think it's a bit unusual, but you know, it's kind of lonely to write. And especially when you're in a different time zone, you're far away from Washington and the editors. It was a fabulous thing, and we had so much fun together because we interviewed people together. We would pick stories together. We went and interviewed mob bosses in Japan. We interviewed Queen Elizabeth, Paul McCartney together, and then we can share all that and then come back and go, okay, what's the lead? And then often Kevin is faster to the keyboard. I think too much and are slower, in other words.
Thinking is not my
strong
suit. I'm slower. Yes.
So he would sit down, and then we'd fix it and pass it back and forth. And when we did books together, sometimes each of us would take the lead on a chapter and then swap them.
Are you the only married couple to have won a Pulitzer together?
No, we're one of two. Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn at the New York Times also won for Tiananmen Square. But it's interesting working together. You learn a lot about the countries you're in too, because Mary and I would often go interview when we were in Japan. We would go interview some government minister together, and Mary would ask some very interesting question of the guy, and he'd listen and listen and listen, and then he would turn to me and answer. you learn a lot about who's the boss in Japan that way.
Because we were assigned very specifically as co-bureau chiefs all around the world. But in many places, particularly Japan, they kept saying, well, who is number one? Who is number one?
They'd call and they'd say, who are the bureau chiefs? And then the person answering the phone would say, oh, Kevin and Mary. Kevin, that's a man's name. I want to speak to him.
Wow. And again, this is a while ago. I think there has been some advances. But it was it was quite interesting in many parts of the world.
So give us the start of the story. Our guess is that you two didn't just become journalists together, that there was a personal relationship first.
Oh, she couldn't stay away from me. No, it was the.
But seriously, how did this all happen?
It was the Saturday before the Monday I started working at the Washington Post, and I was in. I was new. I was in town. I was unpacking my new apartment, getting ready to start my new job, and my new boss called and said, "You're here," and I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, come to the picnic on Saturday. You'll meet some of your new colleagues." And I said, "Okay." So I went, it was company picnic, and there was a softball game, and I was at shortstop, and Mary was at second base, and I thought, you know, I'm going to like this job. this is good.
And you did, and we did.
Yeah.
One funny thing is my mom immigrated from Ireland in the 50s, and she reads cards. You know, she's famous for reading cards.
Tarot cards?
No, it's just regular deck of cards. Okay. She raises money for the St. Patrick's Day Parade, but basically she tells everyone who comes in the house, get a deck of cards, puts them out, and then she tells you what she thinks of you. It's kind of... And she'll say, oh, I see that you have trouble, or, oh, I see that you're bothered by something.
Well, being half Irish, I have to... That's too scary.
I brought Kevin home to meet her. And she shooed me out of the room, took the cards out.
I have known this woman for an hour.
And, wow, you get the cards. One hour of the cards.
Go ahead, you have to.
Oh, and she flips over one card and says, hmm. And she flips over another one. Oh. And then she flips over a third one and she says, I see you will soon be giving the gift of a ring to a fair-haired girl.
And this is not fake news.
This is not fake news.
Yeah. I mean, it's just one way of saying, I think it was kind of destined. Yeah. And even my mom loved him. And anyway, we've been married 25 years, and it is a kind of...
Congratulations.
It's just a lot more fun to work together.
Quick, what's our anniversary?
One quick question.
July 3rd.
So in this collaboration, which is clearly very close, I mean, from germination of idea to finished product, there must be disagreements. How do those get resolved? I mean, Kevin might write something that you go, or vice versa. How do you resolve that? Who gets the final say, or does that vary too?
I think whoever is more strongly feels that way. You know, I think I'll say, hey, I think, what do you think of this? And Kevin will go, I don't think so. What about this? You know, and then it kind of goes. But often, you know, we don't agree 100%. But I think that whoever really feels strongest, right, gets the day.
Some of the stories we're going to talk about are problems facing women around the world.
Yeah.
You know, I reported these stories and I worked on them. But if there came a time when Mary said, actually, you know, as a woman, you know, this is, she just has an insight on this that I certainly wouldn't have. So I would always defer to her on issues of that. In other things, there were things that I felt more strongly about, and that's... You know.
Well, this is a great model, and I'm saying that with all seriousness. It's a great way to do journalism.
The only way it works, so the real key to it is that we're not competitive with each other. If you're competitive, if you have to... You know, we regard each other's success as our own, and I know that sounds trite, but we really do. And we've seen other couples try to work together, and one of them always said, well, shouldn't my name be first in this? I did a little bit more of the work than you did, so shouldn't, you know, this is my story, I want to do this. And you can sustain a working partnership that way, but you can't sustain a marriage at the same time.
Kevin, let's go a little bit deeper on some of your reporting. You reported a story in early April of this year, Lulu's Choice, about a 16-year-old Mexican-American young woman whose parents were deported.
Right.
And tell us a little bit about the story and the choice that she faces.
The story, you know, so much, we've been writing so much about immigration, about deportation. It's obviously top of the agenda these days. So I was going to Mexico, and I wanted to find out, so many Mexicans who get deported have children who were born in the United States who are U.S. citizens. They don't have to leave. You cannot deport a U.S. citizen. So you have thousands of these people in Mexico or in other parts of Central America trying to make a new life, and these kids don't have to be there. They could choose to come back. So I wanted to write about what that was like. So I found a family. Two parents had been deported. 16-year-old daughter, and she had a 14-year-old brother who was 13 when they were deported, and he's like, you know, kids that age are a little bit more, they're made of rubber, right? I mean, he liked America, he liked Mexico. His Spanish was better than his sister's, he was very happy. But the girl doesn't speak very good Spanish, was in a really good high school in Ann Arbor, Michigan, you know, loved Panera and, you know, all of her American stuff, and now she's in Mexico in a school that tries hard, but it's just really overcrowded, in a place where they're constantly worried about their security. where she's been sick since she's been back because she has some allergies and they're worse, their air quality issues. So this, we call the story Lulu's Choice, because she is now faced with the decision of whether to come back to the United States and finish her junior and senior year in high school here. She can live with an uncle, slot right back into her life, and leave her family behind, leave her mother. She's really close with her mother. Or stay there with her family and have fewer choices. She wants to be a doctor, and she doesn't think that'll ever happen if she stays in a Mexican school.
What an agonizing situation she's in.
Yeah. There's a crushing inhumanity to this story. I mean, not to be too editorial about it, but the impact of these deportations on human lives is, it seems to get lost in a lot of the coverage of this issue.
Right. We talk about the wall. We talk about, you know, deportations. We talk about Trump's very harsh stance on immigration. But the key here was to get at least up close one person's story and then say, listen to her choice, and there's thousands like her.
So in this age of so much criticism in the media, we should say that the point of this story isn't to say, see, you shouldn't have deported the parents. The point of the story is to say, this is the cost of this. This is what this looks like. This should be part of the discussion. This should be part of the argument when this happens, not it's right or it's wrong.
It's a more nuanced view of what is actually happening. What was the reaction to the story?
Yeah, it was great. Part of the problem that she was having was that the dad makes $83 a month
$83 a week.
In Mexico.
Right. That still is a pittance.
So the parents have said to her, if you decide to go back to the United States, we'll support you, but we can't afford to bring you back to Mexico to visit us. You're just going to have to stay there. So since the story, five different readers have written in to say, I will fund her travel back and forth. Not just one trip. I will fund her travel back and forth for as long as she's in school up here.
So God, she can go to school in Michigan and see her parents at the holidays.
Right.
We forget there are still a lot of good people out there.
Yeah.
You know,
good people.
We forget that sometimes.
Readers are pretty darn fabulous.
Yeah. I agree.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular POTUS channel. That's the Politics of the United States, channel 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkably talented team at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis, Executive Director of the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. To my right is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. He's also the author of 17 books, and you can connect with him on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guests this week are husband and wife, who also are tremendously accomplished journalists with the Washington Post. Mary Jordan is national political correspondent for the Post, and she's on Twitter at Mary C. Jordan. Her husband, Kevin Sullivan, is associate editor and senior correspondent covering national and international affairs for the Post. He's on Twitter too, at Sullivan K. Mary, you've done some reporting on how to characterize this broadly, sort of the upwelling of women who are candidates up and down the ballot coming into election season in 2018. Some of them, you write, are veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, but others are not. They're just women who've decided it's time to make their voices heard. Tell us a little bit about what you've been reporting.
I mean, it's gone from about this many people who are women running for state offices and federal offices to this. It is a groundswell.
Small to big.
Governor's races, state legislative races, and Congress. Emily List, you know, which supports women who are running, you know, used to have a few hundred calls during a cycle for the midterms. They're getting thousands of calls. It's just one thing. But I also see it because I go to these workshops, you know, that different groups emerge or different groups are putting on, veterans associations, and women are just coming out. I think it's really interesting. There's a lot of women in their 40s who were the first ones to fly, you know, helicopter in combat, or they're the first women to do something in the military. And they have this public service feeling in them and the can-do spirit, and they don't mind fundraising, which has always been a problem for women. They're like, I like the job, but I hate to go around fundraise. So there's the veterans, but then there's also like moms, and there are people who are librarians and business people, and they're just saying they don't like what's happening now. They don't like the divisiveness. They don't like the hyper-partisanship. They just care about And often it's about healthcare. It's often about like some issue. It's the schools or healthcare, and they're pushed to run. So we'll see. I mean, I think everyone's expecting that there'll be a huge wave of women.
So many of these, I'm guessing, not guessing, many of these are women who 10 years ago and even maybe 2 years ago would not probably have thought of running for office.
I met a woman who said to me, you know, I'm a doctor. I have a couple of little kids. I don't have time for this. But you know what? I'm going to run for the state senate because if I don't, somebody I don't like is going to run. So if I don't do this, who will? So I'm going to do this. So it never would have occurred to her to run a few years ago.
I think there's a whole different feeling, too, about used to be you had to be a professional public servant. And I think now that we're seeing reality TV stars, you know, even in New York, Cynthia Cox is running in New York. Just everyone feels like, okay, I can do that. If he can do it, I can do it. If she can do it, I can do it.
Well, you know, this is a great thing for the Republic. Is it not? I mean, this is a marvelous thing.
Well, we were always supposed to have a citizen government, right?
So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think people saying that they want to be engaged is fantastic.
This is a lifetime in politics until November of 2018. But any indication that the greater willingness of women to run will actually translate into more votes at the ballot box?
Well, they're expecting, you know, of course, you know, it's still a ways till November. Right. But the energy that I'm seeing on the ground, like in Ohio, there are people out there knocking on doors now talking about, you've got to vote. Yeah. And so I've never seen that. I mean, there's all kinds of indications that we're going to have a higher turnout. Sometimes, you know, only 40% of people turn out in midterms. Yeah. And I think the predictions are that will, I mean, we have not only the balance of power in Congress, but in the state houses. And the state houses are deciding big things.
It should be said, this isn't entirely people who are opposed to Trump. A lot of people who support him are out there energized, too, because they feel like they like what they have and they want to keep it.
Yeah. So you, along with four photographers from the Washington Post were finalists for the 2009 Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting, and that also was on the topic of women, but not women in this country. This was oppressed women facing all kinds of challenges in other parts of the world, primarily Africa. Talk about that. What was the genesis of that? We're going back many years, or not that many years, but we're going back a few years before the current environment. What led you there?
For years, we would decide in November, December, saying, okay, next year, along with all the breaking news that we have to do, you know, in the country, election, and like when we were based in London, we knew we'd have to cover the prime minister, we knew we had to do things. We always wanted to do one big overarching issue. And we would just decide, and that year we thought the story here is women. That I was just shocked that in England, you can't get a rape conviction. I mean, it is, you know, the mother of all democracies. That is one of the hardest possible things. Even if you, it's just like 98% of the cases never result in the conviction.
Why is that?
It's usually they say, oh, was alcohol involved? It was no intent. And it so shocked me that we started looking at even, it wasn't just Africa, but it was in Germany, for instance, very difficult for women in parts of Germany. And they have a female, you know, chancellor. So, you know, that was an illuminating series, and I thought actually it was maybe even better than the series that won the Pulitzer before, but you never know.
So let's look at one of these stories. In Africa, one family's struggle with a global food crisis. It opens with the image of a woman who spends all day with, quote, an iron hoe trying to coax sorghum out of the hard red dirt. Powerful image, and the story is very powerful too. How did you find this person?
Well, we wanted to write about, you know, there was a food crisis. Food prices were crazy at the time, and we could tell from you know, all of the research that was being done that this was hitting women worse. And one of the things that people kept telling us, you know, the NGOs, people we would talk to in Africa, they would say, because women, you know, I mean, they're the last ones to eat. They'll feed their children. They'll feed their husband. They feed their husband first, and then feed their children. And if there's anything left over, they'll eat. And we thought, really? Is that really? And the more you looked into it, the more absolutely true it was. So we knew that Burkina Faso was a place that was having a real problem with the food crisis. So I just went there, got off the plane, and you know, picked up a local journalist who was helping me, and we just kind of drove through some of the agricultural areas, until I saw this woman with her hoe. And, you know, just went up and said, can we talk to you? And we talked to her and we said, can we spend a couple of days with you? And she said, sure, why not?
Wow.
You know, often the hardest part is picking the right person.
Yeah.
I mean, you can be on the phone, like when we were based in Tokyo, we'd be trying to do something in Korea or Bhutan or India. But really, you have to get there on the ground and talk to as many people as possible, because half of the battle, at least half of the battle, is picking the right person, the person who you can relate to, who's happy that you're there, who tells the story. And so it's a great question, because that's the hardest part, and oftentimes.
Well, then the eye contact, the establishment of trust is very critical, and that has to happen fairly soon. You know, you're not spending a year with this woman. You said 2 days.
Right. Exactly.
So, I mean, that's a rare talent as well that obviously you have.
I think I'd be remiss if we had two distinguished reporters from the Washington Post on and we didn't ask you about what it's like working at the Post right now. Now, the Post has a long history of being in the crosshairs of sitting American presidents, but this is something a little bit novel. I think we have to go back to Nixon to find a president who's so singularly focused on the affairs of an individual newspaper. What's it like day to day? What's the morale like? How has it affected the way you do your jobs? Has it?
Kevin was the last person that Ben Bradley hired at the Washington Post.
Oh, really?
And we knew him very well.
It was a practical joke. He was leaving for.
There's that Irish humor.
We knew him very well, and there are a lot of comparisons. But I would say that, you know, it's an energizing time. Everyone is very aware that it is not a time to make a mistake. It is. You've got to be your best. You've got to be your fairest. You've got to dig deeper. We get inundated with calls, and some of them are people who just want us to go and waste time on something that's not real. But we chase everything down, and it is unbelievable how much time. I mean, everyone's working 7 days a week. It's really an extraordinary time. But it's, you know, you're in there at 8, you leave at 8 at night. There's a lot of things to chase down.
We've never had a president who attacks the institution of the press quite like he does. You know, we're the enemies of the people. We're the lowest form of human life. And then I think he went even farther and called us the lowest form of life. You know, and the trick here is to keep your eye on the ball. Just do our jobs. Stay focused on doing what we do. Don't take the bait. You know, the Washington Post doesn't hate Donald Trump. The Washington Post is covering Donald Trump. And he may not like the coverage, it may make him uncomfortable, but, you know, name me a president who's ever thought that the coverage of the Washington Post was fawning. Right. You know, it just doesn't happen.
You wouldn't be doing your jobs if it was.
Right.
But we do need to stay focused on the issue if we're writing about, you know, a justice issue or immigration issue, and we ask a question of the White House, you know, often they just say, oh, it's fake news. Well, that's not an answer, and it's just our job to keep digging and finding the answers.
So do you get on a regular basis or any basis hate calls, hate emails, anonymous vitriol? I saw your
every day.
Well, if you
Twitter,
if you call 3 times an hour on a regular basis, then sure, yeah.
Well, how do you deal with that? I mean,
you just ignore it. I mean, sometimes you read something and you kind of, you know, you get angry, but the trick is to put your thumbs in your pocket and not respond, because people have, as you know, we all, those of us who've been in the media for a long time, know people have a right to hate us if they want. You know, it's fine, and we shouldn't. We'd like to engage with people, but we like to make sure that they understand that we respect. We're trying to convey their thoughts. We're trying to convey their point of view. We're not trying to belittle them.
And there's an image that some people hold that Jeff Bezos is calling every shot, and he's there every day in the newsroom. And there's also the meme that Amazon owns the Washington Post. Talk about that. I mean, I've read what the truth is, which is he's not involved in editorial decisions
Marty Baron,
at all.
Marty Baron, who is probably the preeminent, you know, editor
from the Boston
of our
Globe,
times.
Yeah.
He was here, and Marty Baron is now at the Washington Post.
Correct.
And he says this best. You know, he says, "I'm telling you, he has never told me a story to do." Jeff Bezos doesn't do that. What he has done, though, is the famous giving us runway, you know, giving us the money for us to take off. And he has doubled down on the money. There was a time not that long ago where newspapers were falling apart. They had no money, and they were laying people off. And his money has enabled people to pay for a much bigger investigative team. We have a lot of people working on investigations now, all kinds, you know, just looking at how public money is spent and taxpayer dollars are spent all over the place.
And you're doing a great job. I mean, it's
but
a,
no,
it's a
he's
muscle.
Not calling any
okay.
shots.
No.
He's, by the way, has a whole other business, all kinds
right.
of other
oh,
businesses.
Right. That's,
that
yeah.
he's, that's
called
and this is about this much worth of his.
As he says, he's got a day job.
He's got rockets. I was at the Smithsonian, you know, and he's got these Blue Origin rockets. Like, I mean, the guy really does have a few other things going on.
A few other things going on. So we've got about a minute and a half left here. I want to ask you, though, this spring we're all about royal babies and royal weddings, and you've actually met Queen Elizabeth, interviewed her together. Tell us about that and what you took away from that.
Well, it was quite something also to be, you know, the daughter of two Irish immigrants in Buckingham Palace.
you know. They didn't imprison you. They didn't keep you, right?
I know. And, you know, it's quite, and she, you know, and she, I just, it's just so, you know, you see it in movies, but then she, you're standing there right in front of her, and she has her gloves on and her purse, and all I can keep thinking is, why does she need a purse? She's in her own house. And, you know, it's just,
but she, we saw her political skills too, because we were in a small group, two Americans from who were at Oxford rowing, and Don Johnson, the actor.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
And
Miami Vice,
yeah.
right.
And she came into our little group and she said, show me your hands. She wanted to see the rowers' hands, and she's, you know, she, because she knew they'd be calloused, and she talked to them about that, and then she talked to Don Johnson. It was delightful because she had absolutely no idea who he was.
and he knew it, and everybody knew it.
But she recovered very quickly and said, oh, I love the West End. He said, I'm here, I'm acting in the show in the West End. So she was, it was really impressive to see how well she was able to kind of
what
read the room.
And what an operation. Yeah, yeah. You know, they had little groups of like four people, and then somebody would come by and say, okay, you'll stand here, she'll come, and then like four minutes later, yeah, you know. Well, but it was something.
Unfortunately, we have to move on now, too, but Kevin and Mary, thank you so much for being with us. It's Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan with The Washington Post. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Storing the Public Square, you can find us Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, hoping you'll join us again next week for more Storing the Public Square.